So we're going to finish chapter 5 of James today, and we'll be done with James. Isn't it amazing? It's only 5 chapters, not that many words in James. We spent 10 lessons on it, and we've just barely scratched the surface. Such is the amazing depths of the Word of God and the great riches that are there. This chapter is largely about the three things that you can control. Of course, those three things are who you trust and the perspective that you take and what you do. And we're going to be talking about a lot here about all three of those things. So, chapter 5, verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. You have condemned. You have murdered the just. He does not resist you. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it, until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Now, of course, this is giving us is a perspective that is very difficult. And it's the perspective of wealth and riches versus poverty. What is the main difference between someone who's wealthy in any respect, spiritual wealth, material wealth, any kind of wealth, and someone who's extremely impoverished? What's the main difference? Anybody ever read about this or study it? It's time preference. The main difference is time preference. So someone who's impoverished, when do they want everything? Now, right? Payday loan. Why would someone give up 20% of their pay just to have it on Wednesday instead of Friday? I can't spend it on Friday if it's Wednesday. I can spend it today, right? I want everything now. The way you get wealthy is by deferring spending so that you can make investments so you can have something better later. That's the way investments works. I'll do something now that's not maybe as good as I would like to have it now because something better is later. Well, this whole passage we just read here is establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Let's start with this example in verse 7. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. Now, unfortunately, we've kind of lost this in our society because we don't have to wait for anything anymore. You want food? You just take it out of the refrigerator, put it in the microwave, punch a number, and then sit there and fume because it's taking 4 minutes for the dinner to go from refrigerated to heated. Who has 4 minutes to wait? Maybe you can pop up a Netflix and watch it for a little while you're taking this immense time to have to wait for this. Or you just jump in the car and go down to Roses and stand the drive-thru, and there's 15 people in the drive-thru, and you have to wait for 7 minutes until they hand you your food. And then, you know, that everything's instant for us. And in this society, they understood that, hey, you know, if I want a crop, like so I can eat, for example, so I have any money at all, for example, then I have to wait. I have to plant. I can't eat my seed corn. I got to save some ears back so I can plant. James works in Africa a lot, and they have there an immense poverty mentality. It's not just a subsistence farming, it's a survival mentality. And in survival culture, which works very well, if you just have enough to survive, then you kind of have to share everything so that everybody can survive. And it actually works very well for that purpose. But that culture doesn't allow you to get beyond that. And when they get to the point, all they have left from their previous crop, from the previous harvest, is the seed corn. They have some sort of a name. Do you remember the word they use for it? Some kind of mourning thing they do because they can't eat the seed corn. They have to wait for next year. That's the one thing that they're willing to invest. But it's a great unhappiness that they do so. So what perspective that this is asking us to have is a time perspective that is true. Okay, so verses 1 through 6 tells you what life is kind of like. What do, in general, people with power and riches, same difference, right? What do they usually do? Do they usually say, how can I serve you with my wealth and power? How can I make your life better? I'm the IRS agent. All I want to know is, what can the IRS do to help you have a better life? Is that how it works? I'm the EPA agent. All I want to know is, I know you already have a good stewardship of the earth at heart. How can I equip you to just do a better job? Is that how they operate? Those who have power? If you've dealt with those people, you know that that's not generally the case. They have power, and they're going to use it. We have friends in this church who've dealt with federal agencies, and they've come in with the attitude, you did something wrong. It's turned out they didn't do something wrong. And the federal agency's orientation is, well, we spent all this time on this. We're not leaving without a pelt. I don't want to look bad in my next performance review because I got power and I get graded on how well I use it. So if I have to abuse you to do that, that's just your problem, you little plebe. That's how power works, right? Companies? Are companies trying to figure out, how can we make other people's lives better? Let's put less sugar in these drinks and charge less. So that, you know, people's lives will be better. We've kind of learned now sugar's bad for people. This whole idea of let's take a 50-cent drink and charge $5 because we put a bunch of caramel in it. Let's don't do that anymore. You see that a lot of that going on these days? No, but you do see people in the government going and trying to get people that are in business to do that. They have zero interest in people's well-being or health. They just want control of the business, right? It's a dog-eat-dog world. That's the world we're in. And our country is by far, in a way, the best of anything you'll find in the world. You go to Africa? You go to the Middle East? You go to Russia? You go to China? It's worse everywhere. You go to South America? You know, it's there. You know, I was talking to a young man in Venezuela. He was part of the student uprising. And he said, we were marching, it was so cool, and all of a sudden my friend started dying next to me. And I realized, I got my little brother out here, and he's going to die. And he got out of there as fast as he could. He went from student rebel to exile as fast as he could. Do you blame him? It's that the government was killing them for disagreeing. Okay? Well, that's pretty much the way it works in the world. And what this passage is saying is, look now, if you have power and you're abusing it, if you have riches and you're abusing it, you know what's in store for you? You know what you're investing in? You know what this investment's going to turn in for you? It's going to turn into condemnation. Because the Lord of the Sabaoth is coming. That's like commander-in-chief. The head of the heavenly army. That's that title. You know, you see the president on TV and you think, well, he's mainly a diplomat or he's mainly the... He's the commander-in-chief. He's had all the military. He's got the ability to punch a button and shoot a missile at somebody. Well, that's God times 100 million. And that's the guy that's coming back, and he's going to take care of that. So what he says to us, verse 7, when you see this gross injustice in the world, when you see people abusing their power, their prestige, their station, just be patient. Okay? Why? It's all going to get taken care of. It's all going to get taken care of. Brethren, this is the 12th usage of brethren here in verse 7. Therefore, be patient, brethren. Have this perspective. Everything's going to get sorted out. The Lord's going to come back and take care of all this. It's just a matter of time. The way you have wealth is don't fall into this way of thinking. This is the world's way. Remember, you got a gear shift. You can go into the world, you can go into the kingdom. And how do you do that? With your mouth, with your thoughts, with your actions. Don't get sucked in just because you see, hey, it sure looks like if you look out for yourself, you get a benefit. Now, there's a lot about riches we can talk about. What I'd like to do is kind of do the whole chapter and then fill up the time we have with some insights, okay? All right, so then verse 9, do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them as blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. Okay, so on the first rattle out of the box, we've got, there's all kinds of injustice in the world. People abusing their authority, people abusing their position, their capacities. Don't buy into it. Okay, all that stuff's going to get sorted out. Everybody's going to get what's due to them. Unless the God of mercy lets them off the hook, in which case we should be happy about that because that means we're getting let off the hook. So, you see other people doing bad things. Don't buy into it. Don't you do the same thing. Okay? Don't grumble and complain against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. What is that? How is that exactly the same as the rich and the powerful abusing their position? How is it exactly the same? When you grumble and complain against one another, what are you abusing? Are you not abusing your relationship with someone who has some sort of a trust in you or has some sort of a esteem for you? If it's one another, that means there's a connection of some kind, right? And when we grumble and complain, we're basically doing the same thing. We're taking advantage of our position to try to control another person. Why do we grumble and complain? Well, there's several reasons why. Let's use junior high as a way of thinking about this. So, we got the junior high clique, whichever version of it. I'm going to use the female version because they use words. You got the clique, and you have to conform to the rules of the clique in order to participate, right? And how do you police that? How do you impose your will on people? Well, you grumble and complain about them. Look at her shoes. Look at her. Look at that behavior she has. Why is she? And you get everybody kind of oriented toward that, right? And that this person's excluded. Or you condemn them. And you gradually let them know, like through an emissary, that, hey, you know you're being condemned over there. Why do you let them know they're being condemned? So they can conform their behavior. So you get in control of them. Well, are other people's choices something we're supposed to control? I mean, we're supposed to invite people to do good things for their best interest. But when we're trying to control them so that we have some sort of feeling that, you know, I'm better, I'm in charge, I'm the little god of my own world, yeah, it's extremely counterproductive. So when we're condemning, whose chair are we sitting in? We're sitting in God's chair. So now we've created a little idolatrous situation for ourselves where we are in control of the world and where we are using condemnation to get our way. Well, there is a judge of the world. There will be condemnation. There is condemnation today. But it's not our job to do either one of those things. So he says, behold, the judge is standing at the door. You know that judge that's going to make all of them come to what's right and true? All of them? All those bad people out there doing bad things? You know who else he's going to judge? Me. And you know how long that's going to be? Not very long. It's just a wisp of vapor, right? Our lives just are not very long. In the scheme of how long we're going to exist on the earth, old earth, then new earth, the old earth part's just a wisp of vapor. He's standing at the door, just around the corner. For some of us, it's more just around the corner-ish feeling than for others. I can start to feel the cold wind blowing just a little bit, you know. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as example of suffering and patience. Now, poor Ezekiel. God came to Ezekiel and said, hey, I'm going to give you a job to do. Here's how it's going to work. If you do what I ask you to do and warn the people, then I'm not going to give you any responsibility for what they're going to do because they're not going to listen to you. Okay? Your ministry is going to fail. And in fact, they're going to persecute you. But if you'll tell them, then I'm not going to hold you accountable for anything they do. But if you don't tell them, I'm going to hold you accountable for not telling them. You got to go along with that. What do you say? There's no good choice there other than to do what you're told. And that's what God's telling Ezekiel. Look, this is going to be a terrible job I got you to do, but it's your job. And if you'll do it, I'll grant you great favor for doing what I ask you to do. And Ezekiel did it. Quite amazing. Well, that's a great example. Look at the example of Job. Poor Job. God's favorite guy. God's up in heaven telling Satan, hey, have you seen my servant Job? He makes you look so bad. you are so abused by what by Job's life and Satan's life. Why? He's not righteous. He's just smart. You pay. Look at what you pay the guy. I mean, you give him everything he asked for. Who wouldn't do that deal? So he said, okay, well, take away everything he's got. And okay, go ahead and do that. Just spare his life. And so Satan rakes him over the coals. And Job says, yeah, Lord gave, Lord take away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And then Satan comes up to heaven again. By the way, you realize Satan still has free access to heaven along with the demons? You know, he only gets thrown out in Revelation. Second time he sees Satan, he says, hey, now you look 10 times worse. Look, see, you took away everything. And he's even better. So it's a real clear what God is doing in that circumstance, because his arch enemy here, who was supposed to be righteous and supposed to rule the world and was displaced by humans, who he's trying to corrupt to show that, see, they can't take my place. Here's a guy that's illustrating there's somebody that's righteous. And so the hard question about Job is, man, well, what's in it for Job? But what you see is that Job came to know God in a much deeper way. In a way where he said, man, I really thought I understood a ton. I didn't understand anything. I see myself as really small now. And God's like, man, that's all I wanted you to know. I didn't want you to miss out on 1 second of living by faith and knowing me by faith, because you can't do that in the next world. So I just wanted you to have that blessing. Now, lest anyone else misunderstand my benevolence toward you, I'm going to give you twice as much as you had before, just so everybody understands. You don't need that for yourself, because you now understand what true riches is. Well, I just want everybody else to understand. So we see that. We can see that now. I mean, you just read that in a story, and this whole thing plays out in just a few minutes. I think that's why we like movies so much. We deeply appreciate a hero that goes through massive difficulty and overcomes it and wins in the end. But we only have about an hour to spare on a deal like that, right? Because we don't want to actually go through that. But life is about actually going through it. It actually takes time to go through that. So he's saying, be patient. Endure. It's an investment. Life's an investment. This is the perspective we have to take. Who do you trust? Do you trust that the judge is actually coming back? Do you trust he is going to make things righteous? And do you trust that it's his job to do that and not yours? Do you trust that if you will invest in people wisely, as James is telling you to do, that there will be an immense reward to reap for that, the positive? Do you understand and believe that there's an immense negative reward to reap if we don't do that? But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or earth or any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no, lest you fall into judgment. This word judgment, don't think is a good translation. It is the Greek word hypocrisis. And guess what? It is translated every other time it shows up. Hypocrisy. And so I think it would be better if this was translated, lest you fall into hypocrisy. Because just think about it. If somebody says yes when it's convenient to themselves, and no when it's convenient to themselves, and the only time you can trust them to actually tell the truth is when they know there's some immense negative consequence involved. Like when you're under oath, and if you don't tell the truth, you're going to go to jail. Right? Then that person's just not trustworthy. All that person's doing is just trying to control their environment with what they say. It's exactly the same as grumbling and condemning. I'm going to grumble against people when I can control them. I'm going to contemn people when I can control them. I'm going to tell lies when I can control my environment. The only time I'm going to tell the truth is when I know the gig's up. Okay? Well, don't do that. Tell the truth all the time. Why? Because truth sets you free. And because what you want for other people is freedom and blessing for other people. So don't do that. Don't fall. I mean, he already told us the judge is coming. Judgment's there. Well, judgment's going to come for grumbling and complaining, abusing your position. And it's going to come for using words to control rather than to bless. We heard that the tongue is like a connector to either heaven or Gehenna. We saw that in the previous chapter, right? So use your words the right way. And use your words in truth. And then the last passage, verse 13. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up. And if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. And it just seems to just stop in the middle there and just kind of drop off. You'd think he'd say some closing, but just kind of stops for whatever reason. But maybe that last thing is just kind of a summary that we should have the best interest of other people at heart. So, we're not supposed to be the judge. We're not supposed to condemn. Does that mean we're not supposed to tell people the truth? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that our objective should not be to get them under control. It should be to lead them to a constructive path. And of course, we know from Jesus that the first step in helping someone else along the way is to recognize our own fallacies along that same way, right? We're fellow travelers and fellow sufferers, not the judge. And then we wrap up with a way to be constructive. So you got evil and injustice in the world. God's going to take care of that. Should we do anything about that? Well, actually, one thing for sure we should do about that is do what Elijah did, pray. Because it's not necessarily just that God is going to wait until he comes back to deal with that. Elijah was dealing with injustice in his world. Ahab, the king, was abusing his authority. He was abusing his money, his riches, terribly. And Elijah prayed to God and said, "Would you do something about this injustice? Please bring a famine on the land so that people will realize that Ahab is evil and Jezebel is evil. And this taking the people into idolatry and Baal worship is horrible." And God said, "Okay, I'll do that." Because we don't have to wait. We can do what we can do in this world to preserve it, to save it. Preserve, save, sozo, same word. And so we can pray for the world. To the extent we have the ability to be a rich person that does something constructive, we can do that. We might look at 1 Timothy 6 real quick. 1 Timothy 6, 17. "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches." This description of rich people we got in chapter 5, 1 through 6, it's pretty haughty, right? I'm rich. I am entitled to be this way. And I'm going to use my position to abuse other people. Well, we can do that. That's a choice God has given us to do, right? That's an action we can take. It's a perspective we can have. And we can trust in riches. So there's three things we can control with riches. We can trust the riches. We can have a perspective that we are special and that we deserve to be treated better than others. And then we can take actions accordingly. That's one way we can do things. And he says in 1 Timothy 6:17, don't do that. But rather trust in the living God. Okay, and we got this in chapter 1, right? Don't trust, if you're rich, which all of us are, right? If you're an American, you're in the top 1% of wealthiest people in the world. And unless you're like in the bottom 15 or 20% of America, in which case you're top 10%. Okay? So he says, no, trust in the living God. And chapter 1 told us if we are rich, we should glory in our humiliation. Because we're in a very dangerous place. Because we're tempted every day to trust in our own capabilities. To trust in our own wealth. So no, but don't do that. Trust in God who gives us all things richly to enjoy. One of the verses about rich man, "Come now you rich, rich man," it shows up a ton in the New Testament. And the Gospels seem to really like the one about harder for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. That shows up multiple times. Because it's such a burden to have great wealth. The normal outcome of having great wealth is to use it to say, "I'm better than other people," and to abuse that position. That's normal. So it's a real difficult thing. So the disciples said to Jesus, well, then who can get in? And God said, well, nothing's impossible with God. So the perspective we should have about being Americans is, man, we're in a tight spot. This is going to be hard. This is going to be really difficult. I can't do this on my own. I am going to trust riches, and I'm going to end up one of these people unless I totally depend on God. And I'm going to glory in my humiliation because He's given me a tremendous trial. So that's a perspective He invites us to have. You know, our tendency is to say, verse 5 there, live on the earth in pleasure and luxury. Okay, I have all this money. What I should do now is make myself comfortable. Another one of the rich man stories that's in the Bible is the guy that builds the barns. And he says, man, I got all this money. What am I going to do? I'm just going to pile it all up and I'm going to live the good life. I'm not going to help anybody anymore and I'm not going to work anymore. And that night, his soul is required on him. The implication is the judge comes and says, well, I gave you all these capabilities. What did you do with it? I served myself. Okay, well, that's not very good. That's not good enough. So it's a tough perspective to have for people like us. Who here likes comfort? Raise your hand if you like comfort. Everyone should be raising your hand. I like comfort, okay? Would you rather be comfortable or uncomfortable? And how hard is it to say, I could be comfortable, but I'm going to deliberately steer myself into discomfort because that's what God's called me to do? That's hard. I mean, when you're on the other end of the spectrum and all you can do is trust in God, then that's the only option you have. Go into total rebellion, non-reality, that's not as hard to trust, which is what James has been telling us all through his chapter here. So have this perspective. The judge is at hand. If God's given you something that's blessed you, it's fine to make yourself comfortable with that in part. I got halfway through 1 Timothy 6:17. Trust in God who has given us richly all things to enjoy. So should we, because we're wealthy, enjoy what God has given us? Absolutely. When you observe people with immense wealth, or at least the perception of immense wealth, the ones that are well publicized anyway, does it seem like they're really enjoying themselves? We get mostly the stories in the tabloids of the people that want fame more than they want wealth, I think. It's not a good sampling. But it seems that those people use their wealth so you can set their hair on fire the most and get the most attention. Like, oh, well, they did that self-destruction. Wait, and you tell you, see, I do what self-destruction I do to myself. It certainly doesn't seem like they're enjoying themselves, does it? Well, if you have something that you have that your material possessions is causing you not to enjoy, get rid of it. Yeah, it doesn't matter if somebody else has it. Just get rid of it. If you're not enjoying it, get rid of it. If you have the ability to enjoy something, then do it. One of the things the rabbis say is that we'll have to give an account for every pleasure we could have had and didn't. Now, we're talking about good pleasures here. You know, there's beauty all around us every day. The clouds out here are just amazing. Do you notice them? Just the reality about what's happening around us, all the fact that we can talk and live, and the fact that humans are what they are, it's amazing. Do you stop and just reflect on how astounding it is that we're alive from time to time? There's enjoyment all around. Make sure you have it. That's what we're asked to do. What we tend to do is say, well, I'm a rich American, but I'm not a super rich American. So I may be rich compared to everybody else in the world, but I don't see everybody else in the world, so that doesn't count. So what I see is that you have more money than I do, and that really ticks me off. Okay, that's more of our normal bent. Well, don't have that. So then, within our own small group, what we tend to do is use condemnation. I want to deal with this. Let me do the last thing I wanted to make, and I'll come back and finish up with what time I have with condemnation. The prayer of faith will save the sick. So this verse 15 will save the sick. The Lord will raise him up, and if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Confess your trespasses to one another. Pray for another that you may be healed. This is good here that they said save the sick. That's the proper translation because this is the Greek word sozo. And so it will deliver the sick. Deliver them from what? The prayer of faith will deliver the sick from something. The person will be raised up. You could translate that made whole, will be made whole. If he's committed sins, he'll be forgiven. Now confess your trespasses to one another that you may be healed. That's actually the heal word. So the first one's deliver, you'll be delivered. Second one's you'll be healed. So what I get from this is that You know, sin creates really negative consequences. Have you noticed? Worry creates stress. Stress breaks down the physiology, for example. So some of the things here is, if we can get rid of these wrong thinking, if we can get rid of bad relationships, we'll give our bodies a chance to heal themselves, for example. But it also says the prayer of faith will make them whole. Now, we have seen multiple ways in our body where God has made people whole. We've seen people who have died, but they died in such a way that you say, well, the Lord really blessed them. We have also seen people that were going to die, that God did a miracle, and they didn't die yet. And we've seen that many times. And God still works. He still heals people, but everybody still dies, right? Paul had such healing powers. Was it him or Peter? If you got in the shadow, he would be healed. That was Peter. But Paul still, if they would touch people, I mean, he had a tremendous healing gift. And then later in his ministry, he says, hey, I've got this thorn in the flesh. I've prayed 3 times fervently, just like Elijah. I prayed 3 times that this thorn in the flesh would be delivered. And God made me whole. How did God make him whole? He told him, my strength is perfected in weakness. He made him whole with giving him understanding, not by healing his thorn in the flesh. Isn't that interesting? So there's multiple ways to be made whole. One of the things I don't think I do is pray for people's sins to be overcome as much. That's something that really strikes me. I don't really understand how that works. Maybe some of you who have thought about that can give me some direction. How does that work? How do sins be forgiven? Maybe what that is that there's this tendency of us to hold grudges with one another. Let's just think we had a whole body who's praying for each other's faults and weaknesses. It would be hard for there to be grudges and grumbling and complaining and condemning if everybody was doing that, wouldn't it?
A parent praying for their children.
Okay. You just create a covering for those kids? That's great. That's a good one. I think that's part of my life. I have a cousin who's a minister, and he went down to South America. He was a musician in a Christian band of some kind. And a guy came up to him and said, I got a prophetic word for you. Your dad or your granddad or someone in your family has prayed for you, and the Lord's hand is on you. You're going to minister to people. He's like, well, that's weird. And so we were talking to him. My brother and I were talking to him at a family reunion. He told us that, and we said, well, that was your granddad. He said, it was? I said, yeah. And we started telling about our granddad. He would get on his knees, and my cousin, who would go and spend the night with him pretty often, said, we would get down on his knees. It seemed like he was down there forever because he was such a godly man. He prayed for his family. He said, well, yeah, that was your grandfather. And he said, no way. Well, those prayers had passed down, obviously. This package of how we deal with one another, it's a huge thing. And now let's finish with condemnation. Can a believer be condemned? Well, this word condemnation, unfortunately, is typically dealt with the same way save and justify is. You got to know who's condemning what to who and what circumstance. Okay? Andrew, can a person be condemned in the state of Texas by a judge in a courtroom? You see it happen all the time, don't you? Can a witness, by their testimony, condemn the defendant? Yes, of course they can, right? Of course people can be condemned in this life. Are we living in a condemned world? What is it condemned to? Destruction by fire, right? It's already been destroyed by water once, and next it's going to be destroyed by fire. So the question is not, can a believer be condemned? Can a believer be condemned in the presence of God for the sins they've committed? No. Why not? Because they've already been paid for. Which sins have been nailed to the cross? All of them, right? So we can't be condemned for that. And everybody focuses in on that one kind of condemnation and says, well, we can't be condemned. That is correct. We cannot be condemned in the presence of God to be excluded from His family. We cannot be condemned for that. But man, look, there's condemnation in the world all over. And if we want to be a rich person who abuses our authority, who abuses our privilege, who spends it all on our own comfort and doesn't do anything to help others, and even who makes ourselves not enjoy the gift that God gave us, we're condemning ourselves. We put ourselves under condemnation when we did that. If we condemn others, we're condemning ourselves. Let me just show you a couple. I've got time for a couple of things here. I could do a whole session just on this. Look at Matthew 12:41. Really fascinating. Jesus speaking. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. Well, that sounds like there's going to be a court case, doesn't it? How did this generation do? Well, I call as witness the people of Nineveh. People of Nineveh, who spoke to you? Jonah. What did you do? I repented. And now I call this generation of Israelites. Who spoke to you? The Son of God. What did you do? We killed him. Well, the jury's not going to have a hard time figuring that one out, if there is one, right? The fact that someone lives a righteous life in and of itself condemns someone who doesn't. Now, you've all experienced this yourself, haven't you? If you're doing the right thing and you're in a group of people that do the wrong thing, they condemn you for it, don't they? Why? You're making them feel bad. And if they can recruit you into their guilt, they'll feel better. You've all experienced that, haven't you? Well, not only that, verse 42, the queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed a greater than Solomon is here. So, hey, you know, we all have our works judged, and we cannot be condemned in the presence of God, but what we do can. You know, wood, hay, and stubble, gold, silver, precious stones. It's all going to go in the fire. I would say it would be an appropriate description to say that if we have wood, hay, and stubble, put it in the fire and it's burned up, that those works will be condemned. But who condemned it? We did. By our choices. By who we trusted. By the perspective we chose to have. Now versus later. Trust me versus trust God. Does God really have my best interest at heart? Well, He must not in this particular circumstance, right? Everything else He does, but I got to handle this one on my own. Well, you know, that's not going to go over well. And there's a consequence to that. But it's all avoidable. And if we confess our sins, He's faithful and just to forgive our sins. So to the extent we've done wrong things in the past, we can put those behind us. Because mercy triumphs over judgment. Isn't that cool? So, summary of James. It's about winning at life through walking in the wisdom of God, walking in faith. And it's about making choices to trust God, to have the perspective that God's given us, and then to do the things that God has asked us to do, realizing and knowing that that's actually in our best interest. It won't always feel that way. But when we do those things, not only is there an immediate blessing, there's an eternal blessing. And these things compound and go on and on forever. So, James, thanks God for this book. Thank you for your giving us this perspective that we're not just on a position where we have to learn it on our own, or we're just at the mercy of the winds blowing, but we can have roots in this amazing wisdom that you've given us in this book. We know you're the Lord of the army, the commander in chief, and the judge that's standing at the door. And we thank you that you're going to make all things right. But we also know that you are merciful. And you have our best interest at heart. And you have our best interest just like you had for Job. And you have compassion on us. And we thank you so much that you have our best interest at heart. I pray that you'll help us serve one another, pray for one another, confess with one another, and have an amazing unity in our body, that we might be an example. And to the extent people don't like that example because it makes them feel bad, I pray that we would just continue on anyway and serve those people as well. In Jesus' name, amen. 2/3 more material, but...